From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, can working mothers ever reach the top of corporate America, and do they want to?
The presumption that this is really what women want, this absolute parity with men in the workplace, it really remains to be proven.
Our cover story, the plight of the alpha female. Also, cracking the heist on Canada's strategic maple syrup reserve.
Very sticky. I wouldn't want to be the saps who were arrested, though.
Also, could polonium-210 have killed Yasser Arafat? Plus, the odd Hitler phenomenon in India.
The Hitler clothing store in Ahmedabad. There was a Hitler's cross cafe, Hitler's den, pool hall.
And later, what's the movie that I could watch a million times? You'll have to listen to find out. Plus, Maya Rudolph raids the Prince catalog and forms a new band. She calls it Princess. Also, the time pop superstar Ne-Yo had to perform in front of Barbra Streisand.
I honestly didn't want to talk to her because I felt like I'd screwed it up, and I didn't want her to tell me that I had screwed it up.
Ne-Yo on a star turn, plus a look back on some of my favorite music interviews of the past 3.5 years. That's all on this episode of Weekends and All Things Considered. For our cover story today, a question. Can working moms make it to the top? And we came to the story in a roundabout sort of way, because it started with talk about the next defense secretary. President Obama is expected to make that announcement in the coming weeks, and in recent days, there's been a lot of speculation over whether that job could go to former Senator Chuck Hagel, or even possibly to Michelle Flournoy, formerly the highest-ranking woman in the Pentagon. Now, last year, Michelle Flournoy stunned her colleagues when she stepped down from her job as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Flournoy is a mother of three, and she said she needed to spend more time with them. And when we spoke with her about it recently, she described what her life was like.
I usually got to work between 7 and 7:30 in the morning, and would pretty much go nonstop until about 7, 7:30 at night. And then I would take a break for an hour and a half or two, on a good day, have a little time at home with my family, put my kids to bed or help them with homework, and then by about 9 o'clock be available again to start working, either by phone or fax or just doing paperwork.
You did this for 3 years. At what point did you realize it was really taking a toll?
You know, I think for our family, the added complication is that both my husband and I were in senior government positions at the same time. He's the deputy secretary at the VA. And so we were really asking a lot of our kids during that three-year period to have both of us working flat out. And while I don't think our family would trade it for the world in terms of the opportunity to serve this president, there was a point in time when my older kids were reaching the teenage years that they really needed more of a parent. And so my husband and I had a number of long discussions and decided that it was time for one of us to step out.
We'll hear more from Michelle Flournoy in a moment. Her decision resonated with women around the country, and it prompted a new national discussion about whether mothers can reach the highest levels of corporate America as easily as men. We asked Katie Jacobs-Stanton, a top executive at Twitter and a mother of three as well, about balancing motherhood with career.
Last night I got home from work a little bit late. We've had a really intense week at Twitter, which is great and it's thrilling, but it's meant that I've come home from work late every night. And last night I got back and my daughter said, well, Mom, I owe 3 dozen cookies, homemade, and they have to be homemade, and we need to bring them in tomorrow. And it was about 8:30 p.m. I thought, oh, my God, I felt so bad. And, you know, there's nothing that a quick batch of Toll House can't solve. So that seemed to work out okay. So you have to take, you know, each day in stride and enjoy what you have.
2 years ago, Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, gave a TED Talk where she described how previous generations of women blazed a trail for people like her. But at the same time, Sandberg described a problem.
And the problem is this. Women are not making it to the top of any profession anywhere in the world. The numbers tell the story quite clearly. 190 heads of state, 9 are women. Of all the people in parliament in the world, 13% are women. In the corporate sector, women at the top, C-level jobs, board seats, tops out at 15, 16%. The numbers have not moved since 2002 and are going in the wrong direction.
Sandberg's message to working mothers was this: don't take your foot off the gas pedal. But for many working mothers, it's not so simple, and Sandberg acknowledged that in her talk. For Michelle Flournoy, the decision to leave the Pentagon was agonizing.
I did agonize over the decision for a number of reasons, including the sense of not wanting to let down the side. But what's interesting is since I've made the decision to step out for a while, I've had a number of young women come up to me and actually say, thank you. Thank you for making it okay to have periods in your career where you do rebalance in favor of family, and for demonstrating that you can do that and still, over the arc of a career, continue to progress and to continue to have opportunities to, you know, serve and contribute. So I was actually surprised by the reaction, because I had worried about, you know, the letting down the side, if you will.
Is it possible to attain the highest levels in government or corporations or academia or wherever and still be a mom, a working mom?
I think you can. I just think you have to, there's a sequencing. I mean, I'm one who believes that you can have it all, you just can't always have it at exactly the same time with equal intensity. My career has looked like a sine curve in terms of balancing and rebalancing. Different periods where I've had more intense career focus versus more of a family focus. And I think the issue is that that's not true for a lot of women, and we as a society haven't figured out how to adequately support women so that they can have periods of rebalancing and still continue to progress in their careers at a rate and at a level comparable to their male counterparts.
Do you think you are at a place in your life now, having taken this year away from government, where you could go back to that kind of demanding life again?
You know, I think we as a family are at a place where we realize with teenagers, one of us has to be out of government service. So I think if I were to go back in, you know, one of us would have to be out. But I have certainly had a chance to recharge my batteries, and I am eager for public service in the future. That said, it would be very hard to miss these very precious years where I have the last years with my teenagers at home.
That's Michelle Flournoy. She was the highest-ranking woman at the Defense Department, where she served as Undersecretary for Defense Policy. A few weeks ago, Kay Heimowitz, a scholar with the Manhattan Institute, wrote an article for City Journal about this very dilemma. It's called The Plight of the Alpha Female, and in it, she cites some staggering statistics. Women now outnumber men in the American workforce, but at the top, the gender gap is huge. Only 4% of the CEOs at Fortune 500 companies are female. 20% of law school deans, even though most law students are women, and just a quarter of senior executives in corporate America. So despite the great efforts in both the public and private sector, why such a huge disparity at the top?
Well, there's one word, children. What happens is that women work fewer hours than men. They take off more time for maternity leave. They tend to also work, they're far more likely to work part-time than men are. And according to surveys, they seem to want it that way. Though we have to always make the caveat that, yes, there is discrimination. But the major factor in the gap, both the gender gap, wage gap, and the gap at the very top, the gap among the alpha females, is due to children.
It seems to me that that is a kind of a form of discrimination. I mean, if you have, as you write, many young women, when they're at the point in their careers where they're really going to get to the next level, it's usually around the same time when they decide to have children. So I wonder, I mean, why can't institutions and the corporate sector and other parts of America adapt to that and accept that there may be periods of time when those promising women will be out of work for some time, will be with their children, or they may scale back on their hours for a few years?
Well, I think that the corporate America and certainly the public sector also is trying to do that and has been somewhat successful. There's a very powerful movement towards flex time. I think the number is something like 77% of corporations are now offering flex time to at least some of their employees. But at a certain point, and this is particularly true at the top, the competition is so keen to get ahead that if you have a young baby at home and you're a woman or, for that matter, a man who wants to be quite involved with raising that baby, it's just a matter of physics. You cannot be doing both things.
It seems, though, that you're being penalized for that.
Well, it's a funny way of putting it in my mind to say that you're penalized because you have children. There's no question that we can do more to try to arrange the workplace around this problem. But I think your question, the way you really implies that there are no differences between men and women. They all want the same thing and want similar amounts of time with their children, similar things from the workplace. That may not be true. So I think the presumption that this is really what women want, they want this absolute parity with men in the workplace, it really remains to be proven. But the bottom line is this. Look, if you have company A and they can deliver a product faster, if they can meet with a client at any time of the day or night, go travel anywhere in the world to have a meeting with that client, that's company A is the one who's going to get the job. So should we change that? I don't see how you can.
Kay Heimowitz's article is called The Plight of the Alpha Female. It's in the latest issue of the City Journal. Kay, thank you.
Thank you.
Women in America earn roughly 77 cents for every dollar men earn. And while many industries in this country are increasingly being dominated by women, there is no evidence that things at the top are changing. It's a point that Sheryl Sandberg made in her TED Talk.
My generation, really sadly, is not going to change the numbers at the top. They're just not moving. We are not going to get to where 50% of the population. In my generation, there will not be 50% of people at the top of any industry. But I'm hopeful that future generations can. I think a world that was run where half of our countries and half of our companies were run by women would be a better world.
But what about women who aren't at the top? What are their options? We're going to continue our conversation in a moment. We'll hear from the former ambassador to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, who spent 3 years looking for ways to close the gender gap. And we're continuing our cover story about working mothers and making it to the top. These are issues Karen Kornbluh knows well. For years, she's been studying and writing about trying to juggle it all, and she's been living it as well. In the 1990s, she rose to deputy chief of staff at the Treasury Department, but after the birth of her second child, she decided to quit. Kornbluh eventually went back to work and rose to become the U.S. ambassador to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And there, she launched a project to improve economic opportunities for women around the world. Earlier this year, she stepped down, in part, to spend more time with her two teenage sons.
You're expected to give 100% on the home front and 100% at the work front and 100% into your friends and your community, and you feel like a complete failure. But I think here we haven't really adjusted to what I call the juggler family, the rise of the family where all adults are working, either it's a single parent working or two parents working. We still have this idea in our head that the ideal worker is the breadwinner with no family responsibilities, and the ideal parent is the homemaker with no workplace responsibilities. And we haven't changed our expectations enough.
As we heard earlier from Kay Heimowitz, her argument is that many women make this choice. They choose to spend time with their kids over pay, that the opportunities are there. There's flex time. There are all these, you know, corporations have adapted and the workplace has adapted. And many women just make this choice. Do you think that that's the case?
I wouldn't call it a choice in the classic sense because I don't think they have a lot of options. We don't have the option to work flexibly and not lose your health care in many cases. We don't have the option to work and have your children in a safe, high-quality childcare situation. Until we give families some real options, I don't want to blame or say there's no problem because women are making a choice when they're making a choice and they don't have serious options. And I think we can look to other countries to see what serious options look like, whether it's a better childcare system, paid maternity leave, flexibility. These things exist in other countries. We haven't really incorporated them here. And if I could just say one other thing, what distresses me a little bit is when the conversation becomes only about the high wage earner, the alpha woman, as some people have called it, the person who might become CEO. I think that's really important. I don't want to diminish that. We want our leaders to be a diverse group. I think women have a lot to add in all of those areas, and our companies would be better off, our countries would be better off if we had more women. But what I want to also pay attention to is the middle class family, the lower income family, where the mother doesn't even have the choice of stepping out.
Yeah.
So 25% of American children are living in single-parent households. That's mostly women. And those families are very poor. You know, there's a very high incidence of poverty in single-parent families. So a lot of our children are in that situation, and those mothers have really very few options.
What would make, in your view, the biggest single impact quickly? Mm-hmm. What's the one thing that would be relatively simple to do? Or maybe not, but would have a huge impact.
Really high-quality childcare, treating it like public education, maybe not the government providing it, maybe just providing financial support and more quality assurance. But the fact that we have so many parents who have no options for what to do with their kids, childcare costs as much as the first year of college, and yet parents have had no time to save.
That's Karen Kornblau. She's the former U.S. ambassador to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Karen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
In Canada this week, 18 people were arrested in connection with the theft of 3,000 tons of maple syrup. The thieves stole the syrup from Canada's official strategic reserve of maple syrup. Who knew they had a strategic reserve of maple syrup? Peter Rakabochuk is a national correspondent with the Canadian Press, and he's been following the story, and he picks it up from here.
Well, it started way back in August when some inspectors were checking in on a warehouse in a town called Saint-Louis-de-Blanchefort. That's between Montreal and Quebec City. And they realized, hey, wait a minute here, there's some barrels missing. 6 million pounds of maple syrup were taken. If you want to put that down in layman's term, that's roughly enough for about 180 million pancakes.
180 million pancakes.
Enough syrup for that, yeah.
I read that this was taken from the Quebec Strategic Reserve of maple syrup. Is that true?
It may sound like a lot, but the maple syrup industry in Quebec has a reserve of about 46 million pounds. This warehouse had 10 million pounds, and only 6 million were stolen. So in the grand scheme of things, that may seem like a lot of maple syrup being stolen, but there was enough of the reserve.
Well, I never heard of that. I mean, of course, we've got strategic oil reserves here in the U.S., and I'm assuming in Canada as well. I never knew that there was a strategic maple syrup reserve.
Mother Nature is kind of hard to predict. So for the industry, it was always safe to make sure that there was enough out there, enough in reserve, so that they would be able to supply the markets. And what was really important is exports here. Quebec produces about 80% of the world's maple syrup.
How did they take 6 million pounds of maple syrup out of the strategic reserve undetected?
The thieves, they had another part of the warehouse. So this was a huge warehouse. They rented another part of it. And it wasn't a problem for them to bring in trucks in and out. They were actually using the trucks to load up the maple syrup and take it out of the warehouse and start trying to ship it to market.
Sounds like a sticky situation.
Very sticky. I wouldn't want to be the saps who were arrested, though.
Okay, there was a huge investigation, and I guess it's more or less been wrapped up in the last couple of days. What happened?
There were two raids. One of the raids was actually done in New Brunswick. Police actually went in, found this maple syrup, and they packed it into 16 trailers. And this is something that's rare. You don't see it very often. They actually had a police escort to bring it out of New Brunswick back into Quebec. So, I mean, the importance of maple syrup, it's an important part of the Quebec industry. And one of our astronauts, Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield, took a trip up to the International Space Station. He's going to be spending 5 months up there. And he brought two tubes of 100% pure maple syrup to share with the other astronauts who are going to be on the International Space Station. So it's a rare and, you know, important commodity and, I guess, a source of Canadian pride.
That's Peter Rakabochuk. He's a national correspondent with the Canadian Press. He spoke to us from Montreal. Peter, thanks.
My pleasure. Bon appétit, I guess.
Peter, what else do people use maple syrup for besides pancakes?
Actually, I was looking on the internet and I found a recipe to make some really good rice pudding using Italian rice and maple syrup.
Oh. Former Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat was buried under so many feet of concrete in 2004 that it took gravediggers 6 hours to get to his body last month. And his body was exhumed because his widow suspects he was murdered, poisoned by the radioactive element polonium-210. Now, at the moment, a lab in France is testing his tissue samples for polonium. Traces have already been detected on his bedsheets and his clothes. So is it an open-and-shut case of poisoning? We called Deborah Blum, the author of The Poisoner's Handbook and a blogger for Wired magazine, who recently wrote about the case.
There were suspicions about the death of Yasser Arafat from the beginning, and I think partly that's politics. He died. There was never a clear explanation of his death. So immediately these stories started to swirl. You know, he'd been killed. He'd been assassinated. But what really changed that was that Al Jazeera stepped up and said, let's take a serious look.
And they actually ran some tests in this past summer.
They gathered up his, you know, his clothes, his headscarf, sent them off. And they found sort of what you would think of as decay products of polonium-210, which is a very unusual thing to find.
It's unusual because why? What is polonium-210?
It's a radioactive isotope. I always think of it as like this hissing, spitting ball of radiation. Incredibly active, has a super fast half-life of 134 days.
Is polonium-210 something that is used to kill people?
Famously, yes, it was used in the assassination of Alexander Litvinenko, who was a dissident Russian spy.
Oh, yes. This is about,
this was in London.
6 years ago or so.
That's exactly right. It was put in his tea, and he was dead in 3 weeks.
In three weeks, right. What does it do to the body?
In the body, it lodges in your bones, destroys your bone marrow, irradiates tissue, it, you know, does all kinds of horrible things to you. And at the dose that he apparently got, it essentially cooked him from the inside out.
Wow. So if they found traces of this in Arafat, it seems pretty clear that he was poisoned, right?
I mean, there's other options as to why you might find these very faint traces of it. He was a heavy smoker. Cigarette smoke contains polonium-210. But the primary way that you gather it in a lethal amount is in the byproduct of nuclear weapons processing or nuclear reactor weapons-grade processing. So there are very few countries, if you're going to kill someone with polonium-210, that have the ability to do that. And the short list, frankly, is Russia, United States, and Israel.
And Israel. Okay, so if they find, and they haven't found this yet, but if they find high concentrations of polonium-210, obviously people will be suspicious. So far they've found low levels, and you say it's not unusual because he was a cigarette smoker.
Cigarette smoke is quite remarkably loaded with polonium-210.
Wow.
Because of the way tobacco is grown. And so you have to say, well, okay, so his clothes show these traces. Was it poisoning, or was it just, you know, sort of being in a really bad smoky atmosphere? And that's not clear yet.
Have there been studies about radioactive poisoning from smoking before?
One of the primary sources of radiation exposure in the United States is smoking cigarettes.
Hmm.
And that's because the fertilizers they used with tobacco are high in minerals that actually include polonium-210. And as these sort of, you know, swirl around, the very sticky leaves of the tobacco plant grab them, and those go into the cigarettes. And there's actually a recent study, came out last year by UCLA, that estimated that out of 1,000 average smokers, about 130 lung cancer deaths were probably attributable to polonium-210 radiation. The Al Jazeera story that came out in July made the point that some of his symptoms were quite like Litvinenko's. You know, he was desperately dehydrated. He was terribly nauseated. There were signs of hair loss. He was rapidly losing weight. You know, there are some people that believe that there's a signature to these decay elements that's unique to the nuclear processing. You might actually be able to say, oh, look, polonium-210 decays to lead. They'd have to say, we've gotten so strong a signal from these sort of remnants that this was clearly a lethal dose. And we can look at these decay products and we can say, yeah, these were ginned up an A reactor from X. And we know that because it's a signature of the kind of fuel they use in that reactor.
Wow. So we may know. Yes. After these results come out, we may know if he was poisoned.
Yes, it's absolutely possible. If they can find that out, then yeah, I say go for it.
Deborah Blum, author of The Poisoner's Handbook and a contributor to Wired magazine. Deborah, thanks.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
Let's turn to India, where all over the country, an unusual name has been popping up on signs and restaurants and businesses.
The Hitler clothing store in Ahmedabad. There was a Hitler's Cross Cafe, Hitler's Den Pool Hall.
Yes, Hitler, as in Adolf. And just last year, there was even a Punjabi movie called
Hitler in Love, oh baby.
Hero Hitler in Love.
Hitler in Love, oh baby. Hitler in Love.
Now, to understand why a name generally associated with mass murder is turning up on storefronts around the country, reporter David Cheftel decided to investigate. And he wrote about it in a recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. He says he first started to notice the Hitler fascination when he'd pass booksellers around Mumbai.
Mein Kampf and some various other biographies of Hitler, but mainly Mein Kampf, were displayed rather prominently because these guys know what sells. So when I arrived, Eat, Pray, Love was out there.
A little bit different than Mein Kampf.
You could say that, yeah. And sometimes, you know, the swastika is it's a Hindu symbol. It's everywhere, but you know, every now and then you'll see one that's the Nazi symbol, that's clearly the Nazi symbol. It's something you notice.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went to Delhi, you see swastikas all over the place, but of course the Nazi swastika was sort of turned 90 degrees or something like that, so it's different.
It is different, but I'm not sure people know that, and I think that's where some of the affinity, or at least the curiosity in Hitler comes from, is that, you know, he appropriated this Hindu sign, he appropriated this term Aryan, which came from the subcontinent. So a lot of Indians assume that there was an affinity between Hitler and India. More important than a few businesses that pop up or the affinity for him is there's no outrage or there's no sense in the community that people might be upset by this. And most of the outrage comes from foreign countries, Israel, the U.S. India's Jewish community is quite small. It's 5,300 people, most of them in Bombay, Mumbai, I should say.
So there's a movie called Hero Hitler in Love. Like, why would somebody call somebody else Hitler in India? What is it supposed to mean?
You know, in this case, in Hero Hitler in Love, this is a love story that has nothing to do with Hitler, but this fellow is nicknamed Hitler because he's got a horrible temper. Tends to fly off at the handle. So anyone who's a bit bossy, a bit of a jerk, is nicknamed Hitler, and this makes its way into popular culture. There's a soap opera that runs in India called Hitler Diddy, which translates as Big Sister Hitler.
Okay.
And again, she's a bit cantankerous.
So Hitler is like a kind of like a lovable grouch.
You could say that, yeah.
Is it because people in India don't know a whole lot about the Nazis or Hitler or what they did?
I think that's the case. Generally speaking, there's not a ton of European and certainly Jewish history taught in Indian schools. Now, middle class and upper class Indians, of course, they know these things, but that the middle class and the upper class are quite small percentage of the population.
But your article suggests that this actually has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, and it seems pretty clear that it doesn't. It's not the sort of the Hitler affinity isn't about anything other than just thinking that this guy was sort of a curmudgeon and a strong leader.
Right, and also that he, you know, were it not for the Axis powers weakening Britain during World War II, that India would have gotten its independence so quickly or so easily. Not to suggest that it was easy, but it came abruptly in the end, and a lot of that had to do with Britain's position being weakened in the war. So a lot of people in India see that as a sort of a positive outcome.
By the way, what do they sell at the Hitler clothing store? Do they sell, I don't know, jack boots and brown shirts?
No, funnily enough, they after the controversy sort of flared up, they're prominently displaying a Gandhi T-shirt in the window.
That's reporter David Cheftel. He wrote about the popular use of the name Hitler in India for Bloomberg Businessweek. David, thanks.
Sure, thank you.
Hey, it's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. And here in the studio with me is our producer, Lily Percy. She is the creator of a segment we love. It's called Movie I've Seen a Million Times. And Lily, you are here to introduce the latest installment on the occasion of my last day hosting this program.
Guy, ever since this series began, I've been trying to get you,
yes, you have,
to record your own Movie I've Seen a Million Times. You refused to do it.
Yes, I have.
But finally today on your last show, you agreed. So here it is.
My name is Guy Raz, and I've been the host of this program, Weekend All Things Considered, from 2009, right up until this evening. And the movie that I could watch a million times is School of Rock, directed by Richard Linklater and starring Jack Black. I first saw it on DVD. I was living overseas, and I was spending quite a bit of time going back and forth to Iraq. And I was seeing things that I wished I never had and experiencing things that were tough and at times would get you down. And I just happened to pick this film up at a video store. I was living in Jerusalem at the time. I put it on, and it instantly took me somewhere else, somewhere that I needed to go, which was into this fantasy world that was hysterically funny and amazingly optimistic. It is just a simple story about Dewey Finn, who truly believes in his heart that rock and roll can change the world.
I serve a society by rocking, okay? I'm out there on the front lines liberating people with my music. Rocking ain't no walk in the park, lady.
He ends up getting a job as a substitute teacher at the finest school in Chicago.
Hello, this is Ned Schneebly.
The job was meant to go to his roommate named Ned. Jack Black's character, Dewey Finn, pretends to be Ned.
Everyone, I'd like to introduce Miss Dunham's substitute. This is Mr. Schneebly.
And he takes over this class, and he discovers these kids are amazing musicians.
I heard you in music class. You guys can really play. Why didn't anyone tell me, you?
So he decides that he's going to make them into a rock band with Dewey Finn, Jack Black, as the lead singer, the front man of this band. And that's really where the story takes off.
Lead guitar? Zach Attack. Take a seat. On bass, Posh Spice.
And the thing about the character that Jack Black plays is that he's so sincere and earnest that he loves rock and roll in the most earnest and sincere way. And he can transmit that to those kids.
I pledge allegiance.
I pledge allegiance.
To the band.
There's a moment early on when Jack Black's character, he starts to sing a song that he's written.
In the end of time, there was a man who knew the road.
And the writing,
was written,
on stone.
On the stone.
He's singing the song he's written, and he has the kids as his backup.
Well, you're not hardcore.
Unless you live hardcore.
Unless you live hardcore
and the legend. Of the rent was way hardcore.
Yeah! Now we're rocking.
There's something magical about that moment and about seeing this all come together. It's just a perfect movie. And if you're just tuning in, this is Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for music. In the 1980s, few musicians matched the consistent brilliance and staggering fame of Prince.
I knew a girl named Nikki, I guess you could say she was a sex fiend.
Yes, we are playing that Prince song. Prince earned legions of young fans back then, including one doting girl in California named Maya Rudolph. Rudolph went on to find fame herself as a cast member on Saturday Night Live and the co-star of the film Bridesmaids. And now, Maya Rudolph's fulfilling a bit of a childhood dream. Together with her college friend Gretchen Lieberum, she's formed a Prince cover band called Princess.
Took me to a castle and I just couldn't believe my eyes. She had so many devices, everything.
This is from their performance on NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, with the show's house band The Roots backing them up. Anyway, Maya Rudolph says she discovered Prince at an impressionable age.
I think I was 9. My cousin Ingrid came out to stay with us from Chicago. She was significantly older. And she brought the Dirty Mind record. And I remember dancing in socks, like on the rug and like on the bed. And it was just the jammiest, jam, funkiest. I don't know, I just never really heard that before. I fell in love with Prince when I saw Purple Rain. That's really what cracked it wide open.
You guys were both, what, around 12 when that record came out?
Yes, I was 11.
Yeah, I'm far older. I was 12.
I remember hearing When Doves Cry for the first time and just being like, what was that?
What happened?
Mommy, I'm scared and excited.
All right, Purple Rain comes out in 1984. Let's fast forward 6 years. We'll get back to Prince in a bit because the two of you meet at college, right? You both went to Santa Cruz, UC Santa Cruz, and you formed a band.
Yeah,
we sure did.
And so when did this idea come about to reform a band, and not just any band? The band is called...
Princess.
Well, it was Gretchen's idea, and I think it came from many years of when I was working at Saturday Night Live and after I'd had my oldest daughter, Pearl. And there were definitely years where it was just really hard to be a parent and to continue my lifelong dream of being on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah. It's a grind, right? It's like 6 days a week, right?
It's technically 6.5 because, you know, the show ends at 1 in the morning on Sunday, and then you're a zombie. But
you sleep all day Sunday, and you're back at work on Monday.
Yeah. But I loved it. It's just hard to be completely devoted when you have an infant.
Yeah.
So I remember standing out back at my house, and Gretchen said, you know, whenever you're ready, if you decide that you're done with Saturday Night Live, we can start that Prince cover band we always wanted to and call it Princess. I was like, I just looked at her like... Morris, you're a genius.
And now you're not just a Prince cover band. You're like the ultimate Prince cover band because your band is The Roots. It's Questlove from The Roots.
He is sometimes.
No, not always. Not we always have an LA band as well.
Yeah, it came about very easily and organically due to my Saturday Night Live family. You know, I knew I was going to do Jimmy Fallon, and I emailed my buddy Mike Shoemaker, who's a producer at the show, and said, what about if my Prince cover band Princess plays and The Roots are our backup band? He said, email Questlove, and I did, and he said, yes, times 12.
So now this is a real thing. This is not a joke. I have seen
no
your
joke.
Performances. You guys are
it
really...
It ain't no joke.
This is real. Are you going to cut a record of Prince covers?
That's a little tricky.
I don't know. I mean, this is really just coming from a place of love, like, hands down. Like, we love this music, and we love singing it.
We're doing it purely for fun, and we've been singing these songs for 20 years together for an audience of zero.
Well,
and
technically two, but yes, an audience of zero.
I want to ask you about a particular moment at the end of Prince's version of Darling Nikki. You know, let me play that for a sec. Okay, that's Prince's vocals running backwards, and I understand that you guys have memorized how to do that live. Would you mind giving us a little sample of that?
I didn't know I was going to be singing today. I sound like a she-male.
Do you want to try it?
Don't look at me.
I'm not looking at you.
Don't.
Okay.
All
right. Ooh, ooh,
Wow, that is amazing. That is Prince singing backwards. Does Prince know about you guys?
He does. Apparently he does.
A little birdie told us that he does.
He thinks we're funny.
Huh.
I was worried.
That he would hate you and he would send you cease and desist letters.
I mean, what we do, it's funny. There's a comedic element to it, of course. It's two women.
Yeah.
It's two women singing these raunchy songs, and it's definitely funny. But our love of the music is not funny. It's very dead serious.
Yeah, I mean,
So I was hoping that he would get that.
Music is the kind of thing you just have to do because it feels good. To me, this music makes me so happy. That's truly why you're doing it.
That's Maya Rudolph and Gretchen Lieberum. Together they are Princess, that's a Prince cover band. And let's leave with a classic Prince song. Your choice. What do you guys want to hear?
Oh, that's like asking me to name my favorite child. Honestly, one of my all-time favorite songs that we've been trying to play live, which is really hard, is Something in the Water Does Not Compute.
Yeah, let's do that one.
Perfect. And if you'd like to hear Princess in rehearsal with The Roots, we've got a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org.
Some people tell me I got great legs. Can't figure out why you make me beg. Does not compute. Does not compute. You think you're special, well, so do I. Why do special women make me cry? Does not compute.
And it's time now for music. That's R&B star Ne-Yo singing the chorus on the hit song Give Me Everything. Ne-Yo, whose real name is Schaefer Smith, is a one-man hit-making machine, whether he's working with other singers or on his own. His new record is called R.E.D. And Ne-Yo started writing songs when he was just 9 years old, living in a working-class neighborhood of Las Vegas.
You know, my mom was the picture of the blue-collar mom, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 jobs to make sure that me and my sister never needed. That was her thing. She's like, I don't know if I can focus on your wants, but your needs, you will always have. You know, you will always have food, shelter, clothing. But as far as the brand-new Jordans, yeah, maybe not.
I mean, she focused on making sure you went to good schools and that you had access to performing arts and things like that.
Absolutely. Las Vegas Academy for Theater, Performing, and Visual Arts was the high school that I went to. And, yeah, man, I got to say that I learned a lot there.
Was it like Fame? Were you dancing through the halls?
I wasn't, per se, but there were definitely kids dancing through the halls. It was one of those type of schools, yeah.
Tell me about your name, Ne-Yo, because, of course, it's not your real name.
No.
How did that come about?
That is a nickname that was given to me by a producer friend of mine. It is definitely a reference from the movie The Matrix.
Ah, yes, Ne-Yo.
Oh, yeah, indeed. He said that I see music the way Neo sees the Matrix. What he was basically trying to say is the way that Neo could do things within the Matrix that regular people couldn't do, I can do things within music that regular people can't do.
Why do you think that?
I honestly don't think that. I didn't like the name when he gave it to me. I mean, I've grown to, you know, love it and appreciate it now, but initially I just thought that was way too big a card to hold. It's like, you know, if you remember the movie The Matrix, Neo was like the savior of the world. I'm like, yeah. I'm not, that's a little deep for me, man. I'm just, at that point, I'm just trying to make music, you know?
Early on, you were really a songwriter for hire, and you wrote some huge hits. I mean, for Mario, for eventually for Rihanna, for Beyonce and others. When you started out and you saw your songs that you were writing become hits sung by other people, was that hard for you?
Not really. At that point in my career, all I wanted to be was a songwriter.
Huh.
I didn't really think about stepping out in front of the camera until much later. I had one previous record deal to the one that I have now, and that was the quote-unquote learning experience record deal. And what I learned was I was not supposed to be an artist yet. So, you know, I left that alone and said, you know what, I'm just going to be a songwriter. Wrote those songs became hits. It wasn't until much later when L.A. Reid offered me a record deal that I tried it again.
L.A. Reid, who used to run Def Jam, of course. And that was it? I mean, that's what convinced you to step in front of the mic and to become the star?
Well, the thing that made me even try it again was that L.A. Reid promised me that he wouldn't try to change me. You know, that was the issue with the initial deal that I had, is that they kept telling me that me just being me wasn't good enough. I needed to be sexier. I needed to be more hip. I needed to be more edgy and this and that. And no, don't write that kind of song. Write this type of song. You know, I didn't want to be a puppet. You know, so I let it be known to L.A. Reid. The second he told me he was interested, I was like, listen, I want this, but I don't need it. So if you want a puppet, you know, thanks for your time. I'm going to go my way and you go yours, and that is what it is. And then he said to me, you know, I dig what you do. It wouldn't make any sense for me to change it. So from there, I trusted him, and the rest is history. Girl, let me love you.
Do you sing all the time?
All the time.
In the shower?
In the shower, out of the shower.
In the kitchen?
All day long, oh yeah.
What do you think it is about a song that makes you, you know, the person you are?
If I could pinpoint that, then I could write a hit every time I touched pen to paper. So I honestly don't know. I really can't put a finger on what it is that I love about it. It's just the most freeing feeling that I've ever had, you know. Age 9 was when I decided my life was going to be music, and I never looked back.
I'm speaking with the singer Neo. His new record is called R.E.D. When I mentioned that you would be on the program, a lot of people said, oh, I love him. I work out to all of his music. And I was thinking of Neo music, and I just thought, oh, I'm out of breath, because I'm always like on the treadmill or the elliptical, and Let's Go comes on, the song with Calvin Harris.
Absolutely. That's definitely one of those get the blood pumping songs, yeah. Let's go. Make no excuses now. I'm talking here and now. I'm talking here and now. Let's go. Your time is running.
Is that the kind of music that you almost prefer? You want that kind of energetic, blood-pumping music?
Well, no, not always. I mean, I could never limit myself to just one style of music, one specific genre of music, you know. So I have to, you know, dabble in R&B and then come over here and try dance and then go over there and try some country music. And I got to keep moving. I have to keep growing.
One of my favorite performances that you've given happened here in Washington, D.C., in 2008, it was a tribute for Barbra Streisand. You sang Lover Come Back to Me.
Oh, wow. The sky was blue, and high above, the moon was new, and so was love. The seagull heart of mine is singing, hey, lover, where can you be?
Were you a Streisand fan growing up as a kid?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Really?
One of the biggest and best voices in the business. You know, aside from her singing, her movies, you know, that's the kind of career that you dream about.
That night when you sang that song to her, did you get a chance to talk with her?
Very, very briefly.
Yeah.
You know, I honestly didn't want to talk to her because I felt like I'd screwed it up, and I didn't want her to tell me that I'd screwed it up. Yeah, so I kept it very brief. Hey, I'm a huge fan. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And I kept it pushing before she went, what the hell was that? You know, I don't want to get that.
I'm sure she thought, what a great tribute.
I was literally shaking in my boots because I could see her.
Yeah.
Like, oh, please don't let me mess up these words. Yeah, it was a little nerve-wracking, but I pulled it through.
You are a father. You've got two kids.
Yes.
You are the senior vice president for A&R of Motown. Your fifth record is out now. You're mm-hmm. a huge star. You're at a pretty good place in life.
I genuinely cannot complain. For whatever reason, whoever it is up there likes me and is making things all right for me. So, yeah, I can't complain.
That's the singer Neo. His new record, R.E.D., is out now. Neo, thank you so much.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, that's it. That is my last music interview for Weekends and All Things Considered. When I came to the program 3.5 years ago, that was one of the things I wanted on the show, an in-depth interview with a musician at the end of each hour. We thought we'd close out the show today with a look at some of our favorites, including this candid interview with Eminem back in 2010. He spoke about his struggles with substance abuse.
I actually overdosed in December of 2007. They actually said that had I got to the hospital 2 hours later, that I would have died. Kind of scared the out of myself.
Earlier that year, producer Phil Harrell and I got to visit one of the godfathers of hip-hop, Gil Scott-Heron. We went to his home in Harlem, and just a few months later, he'd be gone, dead at the age of 62 after a life spent in and out of prison for the vices he swore he'd never give up.
Like, I have not recovered from anything. I did 18 months one stretch and did a year one time. That's a small enough price to pay for all the crimes I committed. You know, they call it your first offense. That's just for a time to cost you. Like, I did a lot of I shouldn't have done. And a lot, do a lot nowadays. You know, if they catch me, I ain't gonna be able to do that no more.
Speaking of music legends, in 2009, I talked with Van Morrison. He was in Washington for a tour that revisited his epic 1968 album, Astral Weeks, an album routinely cited as one of the best of all time. Yet his label almost pulled the plug on that recording session.
Well, I just remember, like, I had to do this. I needed to do it quick. Plus, I needed the advance. Then there was no follow-up, so it was basically like, yeah, that was a great session. Everybody agreed it was the best thing since sliced cheese. But there was like, there wasn't any follow-up. There's no money to put it on the road. And basically it was just like, oh, yeah, well, that was that then, so let's move on. So that's what I did. I moved on.
A year later, I sat down with the one and only Neil Diamond in New York, not too far from where both he and Barbara Streisand went to the same high school.
We learned from the same choir master at Erasmus Hall High School in Brooklyn.
That's incredible.
The girls loved him because he was a very handsome Italian man, and the boys were scared to death of him because he was tyrannical. And if you missed a note, you were out. So, Mr. DiPietro, thank you so much. Two of your students appreciate it and love you for it.
We've tried to balance out the kind of music we feature: classical, rock, jazz, hip-hop, opera, and, of course, pop music. No! Taylor Swift was as delightful as you'd expect.
Very prestigious. I'm very excited.
And probably the biggest hitmaker of this past summer, Carly Rae Jepsen told us how her song Call Me Maybe was being played in all sorts of places.
This is going to be kind of strange to say on radio, but we went to the strip club, believe it or not, and some girls got down and dirty to Call Me Maybe.
Carly Rae, who knew? Earlier this year, John Mayer sat down with us for what turned into an extraordinary hour-long conversation. He was contrite and truly sorry for racially insensitive and sexually provocative remarks he had made the previous year.
I didn't want to be boring. I got in the worst trouble ever, over and over again in my life, from the time I was 4 till 2 years ago, because I didn't want to be boring. Hmm. The only thing you have to do is be honest. But I wasn't prepared to be honest, but I knew that I had to be open. When you're like just open because you think you need to be, but not honest, then you start sort of free associating garbage.
We featured more than 350 musicians or bands on this program over the past 3.5 years.
too many to describe here. One of my favorites was André Rieu, not even because of his music, but because of his optimism and the moment of light he brought to this program last weekend in the midst of one of the worst tragedies in recent American history. Rieu is often called the king of the waltz, and with a simple 1-2-3, 1-2-3, he brings entire stadiums, yes, stadiums, to their feet.
Then you see the whole audience starting to move and to smile and to dance and to laugh, and that's what I want to achieve.
You can't imagine that happening in, like, I don't know, the Met or something. People dancing in the aisles. Well, yeah, but it just doesn't, right?
No, because they don't play the waltzes like I do.
Just a quick note tonight to say goodbye. 3.5 years ago, I was given the amazing opportunity to spend my weekends with you, and it's been the most incredible period of my 15 years with NPR. So many of you have been so patient and generous with your response to the ways we change the show. Over the past few days, I've been moved and touched by your letters and your tweets. Why are you leaving us, many of you have asked. Well, for these past few years, while I've loved being with all of you on the weekends, my family has also spent their weekends with me on the radio. And now, it's time to give those weekends back. I will be back on the radio in early March as the new host of NPR's collaboration with the people behind TED Talks. The show is called the TED Radio Hour, and it will be awesome, so please tune in. Before I go, I wanted to thank some of the folks I've had the privilege to work with on this program and those who have championed it. Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Kenya Young, Amy Held, Megan Kane, Steve Lichtai, Acacia Squires, Chris Connolly, Mathoni Maturi, Matt Martinez, Rick Holter, Petra Mayer, Sean Phillips, Melissa Marquis, Jackie Lydon, Daniel Shukin, Melissa Goh, Steve Mullis, Daoud Tyler Amin, Ellen Weiss, Ellen McDonald, Margaret Lowe Smith, and many, many more I have thanked in private, and of course, to all of you, the community of listeners we work for. So, for the last time, I will say, for Sunday, that's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Guy Raz. This program is back on the radio next weekend with Jackie Lydon. Until then, thanks for listening, and have a great week.